Hello, I'm Tamara Copeland, president of the Washington Regional Association of Grantmakers. RAG, as we shorthand our name, is a collective of foundations and corporate giving programs in Northern Virginia, suburban Maryland, and the District of Columbia. You may wonder why a group of philanthropists is sharing this podcast series on racism. What do they really know about putting racism on the table? Well, they believe that racism, structural racism, white privilege, and implicit bias are often the 800-pound gorillas that sit in the middle of the room when discussions are underway about affordable housing, education reform, access to health care, or even supporting the arts. This series gave them new insights into the problems facing our society. We hope you gain new understanding, too. On this segment, Professor John Powell from the University of California, Berkeley, explores how societal structures advantage and disadvantage people based on race.
Good morning. These are really important issues, and they're also complex. And I think you play a particularly important role in how we deal with these issues. And so I want to encourage you, and you've already heard about having uncomfortable conversations. You know, I sometimes work with organizers and unions, and they believe that you actually, where most things happen, comes out of productive tension, not a quiescent. So when you're completely comfortable, I mean, you know, it's like exercise, right? It's like you don't get that burn, you're probably not pushing yourself quite far enough. On the other hand, you don't want to injure yourself. So it's like we want to give you a little burn, but we don't want to injure you. I think of race in some ways, and certainly, and I'll talk more about this, and racism, a little bit like gravity. Bet you that surprised you, right? So according to most scientists, even though all of us have weight, and most of us know approximately what our weight is, only about 12 people in the world really understand gravity. That surprised most people, because most of us think, oh, I know what gravity is, right? It's what keeps me on the planet. It's not quite that simple. So when you look at it more carefully, gravity is an incredibly complicated process. Now, I'm not one of those 12 people, so I'm done with gravity. And I think of race and racism as like gravity. So all of us have a race. All of us have opinions about it. But when you peel it back, it's incredibly complicated. And the complexity of it is important, not so that we'll, you know, become a college course or not, because it informs so much of what happens in society out there, but also so much of what happens inside of us. And yet, because we have this apparent familiarity with it, we don't spend time thinking about its complexity. In fact, I would say in our society, in many ways, because we've learned in some ways that racism is a bad thing, we spend much of our time running away from it, avoiding it. Can't we get beyond it? And instead of really spending the time to understand it. So what I'm going to do today is sort of try to, in some ways, deepen both the complex understanding of race and how it operates, but also make it a little bit more familiar. So I'm going to try to do both. By most accounts, the country is more divided, both politically and economically, almost any time, more than any time over the last 100 years. Politically, by some accounts, we're more divided than we were since the Civil War. Now, that's interesting. And we're divided racially. In a time that many people thought that with an African-American in the White House, we were almost in a post-racial society. And I literally remember giving a talk at the Democratic Convention, basically saying, if Senator Obama becomes President Obama, unless we're careful, will usher in a new era of racial anxiety. And people thought I was crazy. It's like, no, we won't. I mean, if he gets elected, we're done, right? Well, maybe, maybe not. But there's a lot of things to indicate that we're not done. And part of it was the way that we understand race. Another thing that's interesting about race, and we, in this country, we sort of argue oftentimes, is it race or is it class? And there was a debate I was having with a professor from Harvard. He was saying, you know what? Race And certainly racism is an inexact term. We don't really know what it means. And people throw it around. We should stop using it and start using class instead. And I said, I'm happy to go there if you can tell me what class means. And it turns out, I would say, maybe the only term that we understand less well than race in our society is class. We don't have a clue what class means, right? We're in a society where 95% of the people call themselves middle class. That's a big middle class. People making $20,000 a year, people making $2 million a year, both call themselves middle class. And as you, for those of you who take class a little more seriously, there's no class consciousness. We don't have a labor party. We don't have a middle class strike. We don't have class solidarity. So what do we mean by class? And usually we mean something, not race. That's right. Okay, that's it. And I've written in a long paper trying to understand the relationship between race and class in the United States, and also understand how our concept of class in the United States was deeply informed by race and by slavery. And so this effort to sort of neatly pull them apart is one might call a fool's errand. I don't want to call anyone a fool, but it actually is sometimes obfuscating something to get away from race. And not saying you can reduce everything to race, but saying there's this complicated interaction between race and class in the United States. And when we look at it, we began to see it. And part of the way that race is complicated, a book called Fighting Poverty in the United States and Europe, A World of Difference, they try to understand why the social system in the United States and Europe is so different. And what they're economists, so they have to use fancy economic terms like econometrics. They use some econometrics, which is basically trying to isolate causation. And they say 75% of the difference is explained in terms of our racial history. And they're not talking about what black people get, what even white people get. They're talking about the structure of our society. They're talking about the design of our society. So let me give you an example, because I'm going to be talking a lot about structure. One of the most unique, and I would say pernicious structure in our would-be democracy is the Electoral College. The Electoral College is a way that we actually elect the president. We don't vote directly for the president. We vote for states votes for electorate. That was actually partially driven by the need to actually empower slave states to have a disproportionate influence in electing the president. So the way they structured the Electoral College was that certain groups would go and vote for the president. And in the South, where you had slaves, the slaves would count for the number of electors that actually would be selected. So Virginia, which was a slave state, had a fairly small, quote-unquote, free population. But once you added the slaves in, they actually had a large population. So it allowed them to vote above their weight if you just counted free people. That's where the three-fifths clause come from. So when people say blacks counted as three-fifths, I remind people, no, blacks did not count at all in terms of their own behalf. It was three-fifths was added to the vote, the representation for the Electoral College. Now that's sort of a complicated, but we still live with the Electoral College. And every political scientist will tell you that radically distorts our democracy. It means you have blue states and red states that are deeply blue and red, and you can ignore the voters. Mississippi has the largest percentage of black population in the country, a deeply red state. 95% of blacks in Mississippi voted for Obama. Obama did not campaign much in Mississippi because he knows it's a deeply red state, and those votes essentially don't count because all of the electorals from the Electoral College voted for Mitt Romney. So that's just one, and once we start looking at structures in our society, we see things like that replete over and over and over and over again, which gets missed when we think about race just in terms of the criminal justice system or the police or welfare. It actually profoundly structures our economy, our political system, our school system, our neighborhoods, our tax system. I'll give you one more example, then I'll move on. We had the deepest recession since the Depression. And one of the things that President Obama said when the recession was taking off is he said, we have to figure out what to do to address all these people that's unemployed and underemployed, but the role of government is not to create jobs. Anyone who looked at the New Deal realized that the role of government was to create jobs. In fact, much of our housing programs actually was not a housing program, it was actually an employment program. So how do we move from government creating jobs in the New Deal under FDR, whom Obama deeply admires, to a position that, no, the government can't create jobs? Well, Lieberman, in a book called Fear Itself, actually helps us understand that. And he says, when you look at the Depression, what was going on is the government was creating jobs, the country was deeply racialized, and in those government jobs, blacks were not consigned to working under whites. That deeply disturbed the South. The South couldn't stop Roosevelt from doing that. So what they did instead was to change the function of government to say, government should not be in the business of creating jobs. We are the only developed country in the world that believes government has no role in creating jobs. And Obama citing that, probably not realizing that this is a racial history. This is not economics. This is not political science. This is a carryover from racial concerns out of the 1930s and the New Deals and public works. And so we have, so government just accepts both Democrat, Republican, both liberal and conservative, now accepts the government has no role in creating jobs. My point is that the design of our economy and political system is deeply racialized, oftentimes even when we don't know it, and just accepted as article of faith. There's profoundly growing anxiety in our society, and it happens at a conscious level, it happens at an unconscious level, and it's accelerating. And a lot of people think, well, that's economics, right? It's because we don't have jobs, because the economy is struggling. Actually, that's not the reason. We actually can measure this, and we have measured it. And another book I'll mention is Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. Great read if you have 2 months, 700 pages. And some of you may know Piketty and Emmanuel Saez are affiliated with the organization I run in Berkeley called the Haas Institute. But one of the things he does in this 200 pages, 700 pages, he talks about, if you look at political polarization and economic polarization, political polarization preceded economic polarization. What am I talking about? What is he talking about? He's saying that the tremendous inequality in our society along the economic axis was preceded by political polarization along the political axis in the 1970s. Why do we have political polarization in the 1970s? And you could even say, go back to the early 60s, and I won't keep giving you all these books, but I have to give you some. I can't go back to Berkeley. A friend of mine just wrote a book called Dog Whistle Politics, where Barry Goldwater, when he's running for president, talked about really starting to realign the South, which, as most of us remember, was solidly Democratic, to actually becoming solidly Republican. Barry Goldwater was not successful. His strategy was, how do you actually speak to the anxiety that whites are starting to experience from the Civil Rights Movement to realign the South? He tried and failed. But when Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, he said, I've given the South to the Republican parties for a long time to come. And Johnson was the last Democratic president that got a majority of white voters. And by the time we got to Reagan, virtually every state in the South had become solidly Republican. And what Dog Whistle Politics and this research suggests is that you had a realignment of the country driven by racial concerns. That the realignment was all about white anxiety. This was not an economic position. This was a political position that was exploited by one party against the other party. And to make matters even worse, the Republican National Committee acknowledged that they were doing it and that it was wrong. They said, yes, we're using racial anxiety to whip up votes, and we shouldn't do it. But we can't help ourselves. It works too well. And what started as a Southern strategy to realign the South has become a national strategy. And so we see racial anxiety and other anxiety actually strategically being used to realign the country. So I'm not saying that people using it are racist. I'm saying they're using it for other reasons, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So again, so we're talking about race in a different way. We're not talking about who gets food stamps, who's unemployed. We're not talking about disparities per se. All those are important. We're talking about larger economic issues and how race is actually being used to actually structure the economy and the politics. And what's unique about dog whistle politics, everyone knows what a dog whistle is? Dog whistle, right? You blow a dog whistle, most of us can't hear it. The dogs can hear it, but most of us can't hear it. So what was learned from Goldwater to Reagan is that you can't be explicit about race. It has to be coded. It has to be a dog whistle. So you use symbols. You use things that activate people's anxiety. And someone says, I'm not talking about race. So when I call Obama food stamp president, why are you saying I'm talking about race? Or when I talk about Obama being a ghetto president, why are you saying I'm talking about race? Or when you say talk about Latinos being murderers, that has nothing to do with race. Or if you're the governor of Maine and you say those people with funny names are coming to from New York selling drugs and making white women pregnant, why do you think that's about race? And every so often you have someone who picks up a dog whistle and they blow it, and they realize, oh, excuse me, that was a regular whistle. Because the politics of our country is that we don't want to talk about race explicitly, but people understand that if you can stoke people's anxiety right up to that line, you can organize political capital in your favor. So that's part of the complexity of race. And part of the complexity is some people will say, so nothing's changed. Well, that can't be true. That simply can't be true. If I were talking to you in the 1960s or 70s, I wouldn't be talking to you, right? You wouldn't have a black man standing up here talking in this august place, and many of the people in the room wouldn't be here. There'd probably be fewer women, and there certainly would be fewer people of color. So something has changed. And at the same time, things have gotten better and things have gotten worse. Some people think we will be saved by the demographics. You know, we're moving to a place where there'll no longer be a white majority. That's interesting when you look at that data. First of all, it's overstated. Somewhere between about 54% of Latinos self-identify as white. If that identification sticks, and it might not, I'm not saying it will stick, but if it sticks, in 2043, we will have a larger percentage of white people than we do today. Is it going to stick? I don't know. But it's not a slam dunk that we're moving to a majority-minority country. If we go back to the 1880s and look at the census, we used to categorize Irish, white but Irish. We no longer do that. They're just whites now. They join the club. And the way we do race, and race is a socially constructed phenomena, the way we do race constantly has changed. If you look at the census, there's been no two census that we actually dealt with race the same. Every census we've changed is complicated, yet most people don't know that. Some of people have heard of the case Plessy versus Ferguson. Anybody heard of that case? Homer Plessy, was an octoroon, was classified in the census as an octoroon. What is an octoroon? Anyone know? He's 7/8 white, 7/8 white. So that's how the census in the 1880s used to classify, 7/8 white, an octoroon, a term that we don't even use anymore. And one of the things he sued on in his case was not just separate but equal issue, he sued arguing that he was being denied the property interest in his whiteness, that his whiteness was supposed to buy him certain privilege, and it was not giving him that privilege. And so he was losing the 7/8 benefit of whiteness. Now, it's an odd argument to make today, but it wasn't odd to make in the 1880s and 1890s. So just to give you a taste of how complex race is, it's not how complex race was, is how complex it is. And in fact, I would go even further and say it's about to become much more complex. And the language and understanding we have is not keeping up with the complexity. Let me give you two teasers. I gave a talk recently in Boston. A couple hundred people, they invited me there. And just before I'm giving my talk, they said, Professor Powell, we suggest you not use the term African-American. I said, okay, well, why? Because there are a lot of black people in the audience. Some are from Cape Verde. Some are from Jamaica. They don't like the term African-American. There's a tension in the black community. The black community is profoundly heterogeneous. The Latino community is profoundly heterogeneous. The word Asian did not exist in our lexicon before the 1960s. And so we created new identities, and some of those new identities we created are actually being contested. And so some of the people from parts of Africa, they don't identify as African American. They are more comfortable with black. But it's not just the label that's different. They're saying we are culturally different from people who are, now the term that some writers are using, legacy blacks, right? Some of you know the stuff about people doing genetic testing to find out where they're from. I, for one, don't like that because I think it will actually create greater tension in the black community. One of the things that we had that the Canadian blacks did not have is that we had a certain degree of unity because we didn't know where we're from. So that's changing. Another complexity. The fastest of the large groups, the fastest growing demographics in terms of race are not Latinos. Latinos is not a race, another complexity, but are mixed race couples and families. Nobody's talking about that. 15% of marriages in the United States are people of two different races or ethnicities. 40% of families have someone in the family of a different race or ethnicity. In 10 years, it'll be 25% and 60%. 25%. So in 10 years, about 90 million Americans will be in a mixed race, mixed ethnicity household. No political consciousness, no social consciousness to speak of yet. What does that mean? I don't know. And I study gravity through race, but I know there's some complexity that we haven't began to deal with. And when you look at that, you need to disaggregate that as well. Because when you look at mixed race, large part Latino and white, large part Asian and white, not so much black and white. So the mixed race is not equally distributed across all the different races and ethnicity. There seems to be a special place in this process for blackness. So, and I could say much more about that, but I won't. I'm going to come back to it. One of the ways that I talk about these issues is marginalization, structural marginalization, which some people, myself included, might call structural racism. But let me just spend a second on that. In the 1990s, structural racism wasn't part of the lexicon. That's not the way we understood racism. We understood it as Wallace saying segregation forever. We understood it as Jim Crow. We understood it as the Ku Klux Klan. And clearly, we had made some progress beyond that. Not that those had completely gone away, but there was a consensus in the country that those things were bad. And yet, people of color, particularly blacks and Latinos, Native Americans, weren't necessarily doing so well. So how did you make sense of that? So we started talking about structural racism, bringing that into the lexicon. We talked about how do you push that out so people begin to understand that race and racism is not just about interpersonal relationships. And we worked on that for almost 2 years, debating, arguing, writing, changing. And just as we were about to go public with this effort, I had an epiphany that it shouldn't be called structural racism. It should be called structural racialization. And the reason I suggested that is that we have already an understanding of racism. The racism was too closely tied to personal animus. And that structural racialization, in terms of how people get organized through structures is not dependent upon personal animus. And the structural marginalization is something that happens not just with blacks, but with women, with people with disabilities, people who are sometimes immigrants, that we use structures to actually marginalize people. And that if we're going to really interrupt and create the kind of fair and inclusive society, we can't just look at personal behavior. We have to look at the work the structures are doing. Talking about this session today, I would use the word structural racialization, but I wouldn't stop there. That's actually helping to understand the mechanisms that actually marginalize people. But you don't want to just understand how people are marginalized along racial axis. You actually want to interrupt that. You want to change that. I can tell you're practical people. So what's the answer? Well, these are complicated things. But there's a simple way of understanding it that I want to put out to you. That is, we're talking about not just removing those things that discriminate in society through structures. Think about Ferguson. What was going on in Ferguson? We actually have a suburb that's basically broke. We have a tax system that doesn't allow for the adequate raising of revenue. So Ferguson comes up with a system for revenue by giving people tickets, by basically saying, if you have blinds in your front windows that don't match, they can give you a ticket. That's not just true in Ferguson. That's true throughout four communities all over the country. And a report out of Missouri suggested that even where the elected officials are majority black, you still have that system in place. You have a structure in place that will disproportionately injure, alienate, marginalize low-income people of color. So you don't just fix that by, we already talked about it, diversity is important, but by bringing a black in, if you don't change the structure, you don't change it. So what's the solution to structural discrimination, structural racialization, structural racism, structural marginalization? What's the solution to that? The solution is quite simple. Structural inclusion. How do we organize structures so they do the work we want to do? How do we affirmatively, we're not just sort of saying, let's remove those things that are keeping people out. That's a good start. But I want to go further and say, how do we actually affirmatively create structures that bring people in? So we organize ourselves along multiple axes. Economic is well understood. And so we have stuff like, what's the matter with Kansas? Some of you have heard of that book. There's another book written, which is, what's the matter with white people? And my answer to both of those questions would be, maybe nothing. What's the matter with Kansas actually assume is that people are voting against their interests. And what I want to suggest is people almost never vote against their interests. People often have conflict in terms of their multiple interests. So what are some of the other interests they have? Well, economic is one, political is another, and a third one is who we are, our identities. And there was an article recently in the New York Times basically saying, this election is turning out to be more about identity than about the economy. What do we mean by that? Who we are matters. There's Samuel Huntington wrote a book called Who Are We? And he basically plays on the notion that the United States is going through this profound change, and we have this profound anxiety about who we are. And it's most pronounced in white people. Some of you may have seen the data. When they look at America is pissed off, and who's the most angry group in America? White people. You might think with Black Lives Matter, you think all the shootings and stuff, you think it's black people. No, the most angry people in America are white people. 54%. And about 65% of white men. What are they mad about? And it's not clear. But what we think it is this profound anxiety, the sense of, I'm losing who I am. The next most angry group of the large groups are Latinos, and the least angry group in America are the large groups of African American. I don't know why we're not mad. I want to be at least, the point is that this anger is not just personal. It's being organized. And the thing that we don't understand, it's not people just angry because of the economy, although there are reasons to be upset about that, not because of lack of political representation, although there's reason to be angry about that. The anger and anxiety is about who are we? And there's a sense, especially among whites, but actually among all groups, that we're losing who we are. That the changing demographics is driving a deep anxiety. And most groups, and I'm not saying you're left or right, I don't know, but most groups don't speak to that except for the religious right. We think that's kind of foo-foo. You know, the hard stuff is the economy. Let's focus on that. And what I want to suggest to you is that the anxiety about identity is driving economic issues. And it's not race in the narrow sense. It might be black people moving into your community. It might be Muslims coming in society. It might be Latinos. But our sense of self, which is always in the process of being remade, is actually being deeply contested. And being contested in a way that many Americans, not just Americans, because you see the same phenomena in Europe, being deeply concerned about who we are. The issue for the 21st century is belonging and othering. And when you belong, a lot of good stuff happens. In fact, I argue that in Britain, that the number one good that a society extends to a population or withholds is a sense of belonging. This is your country. This is your community. And it's not just an idea. Is how do I reflect that idea? I reflect it in terms of tax policy, I reflect it in terms of schools, I reflect it in terms of who I listen to. And you've all been in a place where you walk in and you feel like, this is not my place. We know in terms of schools, there was an incident at Texas, UT Austin, but it's now been replicated all over the country. Blacks and Latinos were graduating at a much lower rate than whites. About 20% were graduating in 5 years, about 80% for whites. About 30 to 35% for Latinos. And they spent millions of dollars on remedial programs to help those blacks and Latinos do better. And the article, it's a New York Times article, starts off by saying, maybe blacks just can't cut it. You know, I mean, they try hard. And Latinos, well, you know, okay, they're not necessarily that smart. Or maybe, you know, English is not their first language. So maybe they should go, as Justice Scalia suggested in a recent Supreme Court case, maybe they should go to schools that are not so hard. And there's a professor there who pulled these students together. And he said, let's talk about your experience. Now, as a personal note, I was recruited to UT Austin to be a professor there. It's a great school. I love Austin. And they're taking me around the campus, and they're saying, you know, don't pay attention. It's all this Confederate memorabilia. We're a welcoming school. So they had all of these things to indicate that this wasn't my place. Now, as a professor, I probably could manage that and navigate it. But I can tell you, at an unconscious level, it's having an impact. And so when they pulled these students together, almost all of them talked about, this is not my place. I feel very alienated. And just talking about it and helping students to get comfortable with it, within a very short period of time, blacks and Latinos start graduating at almost the same rate as whites. It wasn't a question of lack of capacity. It was a question of lack of belonging. And once they had a sense of belonging, their performance shot up. And it shot up so fast that researchers around the country said, it's not possible. But it was possible. And so we do things with our structures, with our systems, with our money, with our stories to say, you belong or you don't belong. And sometimes it's just numbers. You walk into a place, and there's a thing called stereotype threat. You walk into a place, and if your identity is salient, and you're the only one out of 150, you notice. You start consciously and unconsciously counting. It's like, oh, yeah, there's another. And it's oftentimes awkward, right? I'm doing some work at a little fruit company that you might know of in California called Apple. And I'm talking about the lack of black engineers. And a woman, black engineer, comes up to me after and she said, it's true, but I was uncomfortable for you naming it in this group of all white men. It's like, okay, I took that as an advisement. But I'm also thinking, you don't think they notice? And you certainly notice, right? So it's not just the uncomfortable conversation, it's actually an uncomfortable environment where we actually have strategies to deal with this. And Claude Steele, who's the provost at Berkeley, used to be the dean at Stanford, wrote a book called Whistling Vivaldi. Now, he took the title from living in Chicago because he found that many upper middle class blacks, when they were around whites, whistled classical music to send a message that they belong. That Latinos from Cuba and other places, when they were around whites, they no longer liked soccer. They liked football. They were doing things to perform, to say, you can be comfortable with me. It's complicated. I want to suggest something else as well. So when we talk about a multi-racial, multi-ethnic society, there's been a number of stories saying that whites are oftentimes uncomfortable with this, and there's a reason for it. I've done some research, colleague Vicky Plout has done a lot of research, because what whites hear in this changing demographic, in this emerging story, is that they're losing. The way we talk about race in a society is about, use race to actually talk about black people, right? We can show at an unconscious level that when people hear the term race, the image that comes to mind is a black person. In fact, I was teaching some of this in class, and one of my forthright white students said, you know, where are white people in this story? I said, what do you mean? So you keep talking about race. What about white people? I said, well, I think the last time I looked, white was a race too. I said, oh, yes, right. But when we talk about race, we think we're talking about the other, the racial other. And so part of it is actually to actually not recenter whiteness, but to include it, but also to talk about how race has been used to profoundly marginalize some groups and apparently advantage others. So our identities are multiple. Our identities are deeply relational. And our identities are deeply situational. Zora Neale Hurston talks about the only time when she first became aware of being a black woman is when she's around white people. So our race actually shifts, our salience of our race shifts depending on the environment we're in. Can we create an environment where we are comfortable, not so comfortable that we're asleep, but comfortable enough to actually perform? How do we create a sense of really belonging, not as an idea, but as a reality? Now think about something like segregation. When you read the Supreme Court case Brown, they talk about the symbolism of segregation. The segregation says to black students, you do not belong. So they're saying, even if we could make the resources the same, which we've never been able to do, but even if we could, we're still saying to black students, you do not belong. Segregation is not just a separation of blacks from whites or whites from Latinos or white from Native American. It's actually sending a message, and it's a way of distributing resources and identity. The identity that you belong, identity that you'll be other. As Asians say, they're perpetual foreigners. They could be here for 10 generations, and it's still like, you're the other. You don't belong. It's like, wow, you speak English without an accent. That's because, you know, why do I have to have an accent? And again, so this phenomena of belonging and othering is a deep message. Because part of the way we constructed, I would say, the closed white identity is the need to either exclude or dominate the other. And so I think we also need a new white identity that's not based on the need to exclude or dominate. The stories that we actually convey to each other through culture, to our unconscious about the status of whites. I'm watching a movie with my daughter, and it's a horror movie. And there's this young blonde girl at home by herself, and of course there's a monster in the closet, and she gives her a go to the closet, she puts a hand on the door, and my daughter goes, and I said, you know, nothing's going to happen to that girl. It's like, why do you say that? And then the doorbell rings. Here comes the pizza guy. He's a Latino. And she goes to get some money. The monster comes out the closet and eats the pizza guy. And my daughter says, oh, you've seen this movie before. I said, as a matter of speaking, so I've already spoken to the anxiety. I would just say it is big. That anxiety in society is huge. It's not just a personal feeling, and it's being used inappropriately. The thing about anxiety is that unless it's named, it continues to run us. So it doesn't work to say, let's not talk about race. In fact, I want to suggest to you, certainly since Barry Goldwater, we as a country have been talking about race with a script. And we've gotten better and better at it by talking about it without naming it. And we've done it mainly in a destructive way. And we've done it strategically. Not because we are more racist, but because it gives us a chance of reordering the political system. One of the things that's become more pronounced in our discussion of race is the whole thing around implicit bias. So what is implicit bias? We process about 40 bits of information a second, consciously. You may ask what a bit is. If you have a cell phone, ask Mr. Google. But the point is, your cell phone has so many bits. It's just how much information a bit is like, you know. Chunks of information. We can process 40 bits of information a second. During that same second, we process 11 million bits of information unconsciously. So 40 bits consciously, 11 million bits unconsciously. The unconscious is doing all the work. In fact, some researchers say the conscious is a fraud. And the unconscious is largely social, not individual, which is also counterintuitive. The unconscious is also deeply habituated. It actually is very fast, very crude, and what it notices is habits. Ring a bell, feed the dog. Ring a bell, feed the dog. Now you just ring the bell, the dog starts salivating. Because two things have happened in a pattern over and over again, and the unconscious has drawn a connection. There's a connection between bells and food and eating. All of us are like that. That's how our unconscious minds are situated. So when we see pictures of a black man on television and crime over and over again, our unconscious, not individually, but collectively, draws a causal connection. And we can demonstrate this. We can actually test the unconscious. This is not the unconscious of Freud. We can test the unconscious to see how the unconscious is responding to different racial and gender and other cues. And America, especially white America, is deeply habituated around racial meaning, which creates anxiety, which creates discomfort. And the unconscious is more accurate in terms of predicting behavior and outcomes than the conscious. In this way, popular culture, what we see, what we hear, and we see it even in young kids. A lot of people say, well, the millennials, they don't care about race. Maybe at a conscious level they don't, but the unconscious, they're not much better. In some ways, they're worse than the older generation. The unconscious is also interacting with the environment. What we see, we don't see a woman in front of a classroom teaching math. When we walk into a classroom teaching, woman teaching math, we start to experience anxiety. What is she doing there? Am I going to really learn math? And that's all at an unconscious level. Now, I want to make it clear, I don't call this unconscious racism. In fact, what we can show is that in terms of association with crime and race, blacks actually have similar, but not as profound associations as whites. Why is that? Because it's coming from the environment. Blacks are in the same environment as whites. They're hearing that same bell as whites. But it's not as profound. Why is it it's not profound? Because I know my father. So if I'm seeing blacks being violent and committing crimes all day on television, I then go have dinner with my dad. And so I have some mediating factor. Most whites don't have that mediating factor. Their experience of blacks is on television, is on movies, is that's all they have. We find the people who have the most extreme attitude toward Muslims are the people who've never met a Muslim. They have nothing to mediate all this information they're getting. And so, again, it's not the same as racism. And it's not the same as saying, okay, don't be prejudiced or don't think about race. The unconscious is radically politically incorrect. So I often say, you know, the conscious is trying not to notice something. It's like, well, I'm not going to notice that that person is race or gender. The unconscious is fast, right? And it's also unruly. The unconscious actually does things at a rate that the conscious simply can't keep up. So the unconscious has actually noticed, had a meeting, sent a memo, and acted before the conscious comes online. And we can show that. Think about this in your own life. The unconscious, deeply habituated. Think about when you first learned to drive. You have all the stuff you're trying to deal with, and it's so hard. You know, it's like, I remember learning to drive myself, and I grew up in Detroit. My dad's taking me out, my first road test, and I'm driving, and it's like, you know, no radio, no conversation, both hands on the wheel, I'm completely attentive. And my dad says, okay, John, you can go over 20. It's like, no, this is fast enough, you know. And literally, I remember saying, okay, now we're going to go on the freeway. I'm not going on the freeway. That's just crazy. Why would someone do that? And then after it becomes habituated, you're driving 60, 70, you listen to the radio, you're talking on the phone, you're eating. You know, it's like, because a lot of that stuff has been consigned to the unconscious. The unconscious is fast. So we can't get beyond the unconscious. That's the point. We cannot live without the unconscious. So in the book, Thinking Fast and Slow, the author says, I don't use stereotypes as a negative evaluation. It is a clinical fact. That is, we can't live without stereotypes. It's what the unconscious does. It makes these associations based on the patterns it sees in the larger society. We don't just see the world. The unconscious fills in. It sorts into categories, it creates association, and it fills in gaps. Structures are systems, and there's no single causation. So you need to look at how things are interactive. The most effective thing to do is not to focus on the individual perpetrator, but to focus on the network that a person has. Networks are extremely important. 83% of jobs obtained through networks, not by reading an ad in the newspaper. So what I say to my students, when you graduate, whether you're an A student, hard worker, computer science, what would determine you get, whether you get a job or not is not how well you did by itself, 13%, but what network you have. So literally when I advise students about going to college, I say, think about the network you want to be in 10 years from now and which school will put you in a better network. Now, how does that deal with race? I'll give you a very quick example. Project in Cleveland. We looked at black and white businesses that grew at the same rate for 6 years. Then the black businesses stall. The white businesses continue to grow. They invited me in to help understand that and try to make some intervention. And initially, there was some hostility, especially from the black businessmen. It's like, why are they paying you money to tell us what we already know? This is racism. And I said, well, you're probably right, but since I'm here, and I do want to get paid, why don't we just talk anyway? Because it didn't make sense to me if it was just racism in the narrow sense. Why did it take 6 years to kick in? And what we found was that businesses grew for the first 6 years based on debt. After 6 years, it grew based on equity and equity investments. And equity investments, this was 15, 20 years ago, was driven by networks. So I have a business. It's growing really fast. Now I want to grow it some more. I need an investment of $200,000. Who do I know that can invest $200,000 in it? Turns out that the white community has a network of wealth that the black community does not. And because we're segregated, there's no one in my family I can call up and say, hey, Cletus, I got a good deal. Do you have $100,000? He would say, what? And so we actually had to create a venture capital fund for the black community and a network, and then the business start growing. This is an example of structural racialization. It was the structure itself that was impeding the growth. There wasn't racial hostility in the narrow sense. So, and there are all kinds of examples like this. Structures are never neutral. We think of structures as largely neutral. You think of an escalator, get people from the first floor to the third floor, and then a guy comes along in a wheelchair. That structure doesn't work for that person. We could blame the person, or we could say that the structure is problematic. We want to have universal goals and targeted strategies based on how groups are situated within structure and culture. Universal goals. And the goal is not to get what white people have. The goal is to get whatever we think is appropriate. Let's say what that is. And then let's look at how groups are situated in relationship to their goal and how they're situated in relationship to structures and culture, which means race as a proxy, how the black community is situated, how the white community is situated, how Latinos, how the women, they're all situated differently, which means different strategies and different inputs for those groups to get into that goal. How do we make structures actually help us get to the goal we want? How do we invest in that process? And so again, it's what I call targeted universalism. Universal goals, targeted strategies based on our situatedness. Now, I talked about strategies of actually using anxiety to promote outcomes. But the mechanism for doing that is through government. Government makes the rules of the game. Government is actually key in terms of many of the structures that we live in. Part of the thing becomes, how do we actually create a government that's responsive to the needs of people? And we hear a lot about government can't do anything, the public is bad, we should turn everything over to the private sector. Well, it's just all that's problematic on so many levels. Most data suggests government has actually gotten bigger since our revolution against government. But what's happened is government has switched sides. It hasn't gone away. It's actually switched sides. So many, as many rules and regulations, but not in favor of people, in favor of the elite. We just doing a report on the TPP showing new government structures, new judicial structures, new business structures, all favoring the elite. And the strategy to get us to actually switch sides with government is a claim that government has been captured for the moochers, that we're using government to help people who don't really need help, helping people who are on welfare, taking taxpayer money and giving it to people who don't deserve it. So we racialize government's role for people to actually switch government so that it's actually working for the elites. So this is actually, and I'll end by just saying this, we actually misappropriate the role of government. So I argue that the role of government and the economy is to serve people, not the other way around. And that we use race to actually demonize government in that role. And therefore, we restructure the economy in a way that creates greater and greater inequality, and to the point which now some economists are calling it toxic inequality, that undermine our democracy and even undermine our economy. And race is the driver for that. But the purveyor of it is government itself. And so there's this link between the economy, government, and race. And this is some of the complexity when I talk about race being like gravity, and most people don't understand it. And so it takes us all the way back to, are we talking about class? Are we talking about race? We're talking about both and how they're related and the mechanisms for changing that. Targeted universalism, structures, the unconscious, not simply interpersonal behavior, not even simply diversity, but structures themselves.
John Gardner, founder of Common Cause and the Independent Sector, said, "The first step of leadership is not action, it's understanding. For too long, we have not focused on understanding racism in our society. I hope this Putting Racism on the Table podcast series has broadened and deepened your understanding."